Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Jordy Visser, President and Chief Investment Officer at Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors. Jordy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. Certainly, we're not short on topics to discuss today with today's markets. And, you know, I think what really makes your teams and companies' viewpoints are, you know, thinking about in terms of multi-strategy. So sometimes we talk to people who are just equity strategists. So all they think about things are in terms of being an equity allocator, as opposed to really taking much more of a broader view sort of on what the dynamics are in the market. Maybe just start though, you can walk everyone through, who Weiss is, what you all do, and maybe a little bit about your background as well.
All right. In terms of Weiss, it's unique in the industry in the fact that, first of all, we are a 40-plus-year-old company that began with George Weiss, the founder, basically starting a philosophy around market neutral. He was one of the pioneers of market neutral, starting in the 70s and really running a business in a way that we still do today, meaning a diversified portfolio that is run in a not only a market neutral, but I think as time has changed, more factor neutral with a lot of turnover. So every type of, let's say, multi-manager or multi-strategy fund has a different philosophy. We are a multi-strategy fund that focuses on diversification, neutrality, but also turnover. It was open to investors throughout the 70s and 80s, and then really closed off to investors until I joined in 2005. We launched outside investors with the hedge fund in 2006. And then we started getting demands from some of our clients for not only a traditional hedge fund vehicle, but for something that had a little bit more liquidity, but still offered the philosophy that George had founded. And so now we have about 100 employees. We're about $4 billion under management. The firm has been growing in a nice manner. And the philosophy that George started still carries on today. In terms of my background, I have been in markets since 1992. I started at Morgan Stanley, started in the coding, risk management area, built some systems, moved to the trading floor on the derivative side. I have a background that's primarily in derivatives and traded the emerging markets throughout the 90s, moved back to the US, took over the S&P 500 option book, took over the ETF business. And then I left subsequently in 2003, started my own macro fund, did that for 2 years, brought my team into Weiss. And since then I've been here and was made the CIO during the great financial crisis in 2008, and then subsequently became the president a few years later.
That's great. And certainly a depth of experience. You know, kind of just to jump right into it, certainly a lot going on with the markets. How do you kind of take all this information in and kind of distill it just as part of your overall philosophy to kind of create your macro outlook for how you think you want the firm to invest?
Well, it's an important question, I think, not only for me on the show, but I think for anyone who's watching, listening, who has investments with any kind of funds, you want to understand their investment process from how they deal with certain environments. We have focused, obviously, with a turnover-based approach, meaning we're looking for managers who have a a Bayesian belief in their head. Behind me, you can probably see a chart of a brain bias chart, which goes through. We spend a lot of time on behavioral decision making, which is really important during times like this. But I would say over the last 3 years, we've seen a significant shift from a world that maybe was a lot more quiet from 2010 to 2016. And I say that because we had QE, we had kind of a thing where the Fed put was there, we had low inflation, we had kind of boring growth, but continuing at a slow basis. And now we've entered a period where we talk about vol is much higher. There's more anxiety-filled times. We had the trade war with China from 2018, 2019. Then you had COVID 2020, 2021. Now we've got Ukraine, Russia. We've got inflation. In a world with, let's say, less certainty, which is where I think we are, it puts a higher premium on your investment process to be adaptable. And so for us, we're trying to find people that can handle the pressures of coming in and knowing that there's more corrections than there used to be, where liquidity drops off very quickly. And I think for a lot of the people, probably this year, more importantly, it's been one of the worst years for stocks already, at least through last week, that we've seen in the last 50 years, if the year ended today. And for the bond market, it's arguably been the worst year. So when you have a year where bonds are down and stocks are down, and you've got World War III talk, and you've got all this stuff going on, I think it puts a high pressure on investors to be able to make decisions. But when you're a turnover-based fund, you need people who are willing to provide liquidity. And so we search in the investment process for that, and the people we hire, we're looking for that.
And so you talked a lot about, you know, this kind of adaptability and kind of process orientation. I'm kind of curious, you know, how much, you know, during periods of market location, do you, you know, try to tell the team to stick to what they kind of core do on a core basis? First, how much of this is really about being adaptable and taking what the market kind of gives you and maybe doing things that are outside of the core mandate that you typically operate under?
Yeah, it's a good question, because whenever you say liquidity providing, it means by definition, you're trying to step into some things that that the market's going the other direction. And that really becomes important on a panic side. I think the way that I try to help the teams is something you said, which is during times of, let's say, increased crisis, since we're having a fairly unique period where the market is clearly, both stocks and bonds are being sold off aggressively, fears are rising, you don't want to be too early into these situations. So you start looking and kind of talking to the team on something you've said, which is focus on the less liquid positions and make sure those are gone from the portfolio. The opportunities and the liquid positions will make more sense. And that's probably been the most important message of this year. One of the beliefs I have is that these overvalued innovation and growth names, due to both structurally higher inflation, a realization that liquidity is not available, but also now a significant decline from the peaks in 2020, that those names are just not going to be a place to be focused on for the next year or two. And everyone seems to be trying to pick a bottom. What we're looking to provide liquidity in is areas of the market that are more sensitive to inflation, areas that are under-owned, commodities, particularly energy and materials, some of the industrials that are sensitive to that. But it's a very different world. So when you're liquidity providing, you want to help the PMs with giving them what the environment will look like, not just today, but in 6 to 12 months, and then sometimes even a little bit further. So we're kind of in that area now where I think we're starting to be more aggressive with providing liquidity, because we've seen more signs in the last, I would say, 2 weeks, that a lot of energy has been spent by people liquidating portfolios. And that means we're kind of reaching an inflection point where we think liquidity providers take over.
So, you know, I think there's a lot there that we can discuss, especially on kind of your outlook, you know, today and going forward, and where maybe some opportunities are presenting themselves as you all see fit. But kind of curious, maybe to start, could you kind of give everyone some insight into, you know, what you thought about the world in December, as far as what your 2022 outlook was and kind of what were some of the core theses? And then let's talk about how those kind of evolved with some of the, with Ukraine, Russia, and some other factors that have come into play so far to start the year.
Yeah, and I'll say this with the ability of everyone always being able to go check what I'm about to say. Luckily for everyone, I do a weekly podcast and I do webinars about every 2 weeks, and I write, which means all of my views are on our website, which gives people the chance to see this. But for me, going into this year, there were First, when it came to stocks, I believe the stock market would finish up this year, but have one of its, let's say, worst years over the last 11, meaning up less than 10%. With inflation up at, you know, 6 to 7, you're dealing with not that much in terms of real returns, but still believe nothing has changed. I still think stocks will finish up for the year, which is a lot to say when you're down around double digits. But the reason for it and the primary goal, number one, we are in a higher inflation world. And I think what all people at home need to start to identify, every day that you have money sitting in cash, you are losing money because inflation is structurally higher. And this has not existed for most of this. When people talk about the 1970s, they have to remember that keeping money in cash was paying you money. It's not paying you now. And so because I think bonds are uninvestable, I just think if you have money in bonds with yields at this level, you're really taking a chance here that you're not going to have negative performance. We had negative performance in bonds last year. We're going to have negative performance in bonds again this year, is my belief. And more importantly, inflation remains at the highest level in most of our careers, if not almost everyone listening. So what you're left with is stocks finish up on the year for no other reason, because they do better in inflationary periods, and bonds are just priced at a very, they're mispriced. Second thing is, you have to have a view on the Fed for this year. And one of the things that I want to make sure I emphasize, because a lot of people are scared of how aggressive the Fed can go, it is very, very difficult for the Fed to do what Paul Volcker did in the 1980s. And the reason is, which doesn't get put in the press too much, our interest expense is extremely high if we raise rates, not only at the national level from the federal debt, but also for the corporate level. You didn't have these problems in the 1980s because debt was very low relative to GDP. So you're in this trap situation. They want to fight inflation. It's a government issue. The White House wants inflation to be there because it's having impacts on the polls. But the reality is they can't go too fast. So if you're going to end up in a world where inflation is going to be higher than where the Fed is moving rates, stocks should do better, commodities should do better, and you want to underinvest in bonds. And then I'll say this, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but I'm very fixated on the crypto market as part of this, as an asset class. I think all investors, and I've been on as part of my Outlook paper was that you should have at least 5% in crypto at this point, partly for the view that I'm happening, but partly as an innovation hedge to the other innovation names that people are overweight in. So that's been my outlook. I'll just mention two things. One is inflation will stay structurally higher than what people believe. Number two, the housing market is in a durable side. So you're not going to have a housing drop off like you did post the great financial crisis. And then thirdly, the other difference that's really important for people to keep in mind, we have a labor shortage. And so wages are growing and the upward side of wages will continue, which will offset some of the inflation side. This is very different than the 1970s, where when people talk about stagflation, I associate stagflation with higher inflation, lower real GDP. I think both of those are true, but also high unemployment rates. I don't see that happening. And so this is a very different thing, and it should be good for stocks, bad for bonds, good for commodities.
And so, you know, just kind of having seen, you know, December, I think late Q4 last year, we saw some volatility creep into equity markets with some, you know, more noticeable drawdowns than what had occurred, you know, basically post the COVID pandemic, or at least the beginning of it. You know, now knowing, you know, 3 months or so in, seeing some, you know, relatively large in magnitude sell-offs, especially at the subsector level of the S&P, what's kind of changed in your minds here? And then let's kind of pivot a little bit into Ukraine and Russia and how you think that kind of plays out. But just knowing, you know, that, for example, this high growth tech has really kind of started to sell off. How does that impact your views overall in the equity markets now knowing this a couple months later?
Well, I think your question, Peter, if people didn't adapt in November of last year to a very important inflection point, I think rather than focus and think that they have to adapt now, I think what the Fed did to people was pull the rug out from underneath them. And I think a lot of people have forgotten this because we go through these crises and these, I mean, think about COVID last year and just how many different involvements we have. But then you had Evergrande with China. In late November, right around Thanksgiving, Jerome Powell, Chairman Powell, basically took transitory out of his speaking. Then we got the Fed statement a few weeks later in December that literally took transitory out. Until that point, for all of last year, despite higher inflation numbers, people were still investing in tech and growth names, ignoring the fact that inflation was likely to be higher because the Fed said it's transitory, which gave people hope. And then secondly, it said they're not raising rates until 2023. Well, here we are in 2022, and we now have seven tightenings built into the market. So the rug was pulled out of investors in November, and I think the majority of people did not take that as an important point. The reality is rates are going higher for the foreseeable future because inflation is going to stay high. Now, I don't think they're going to spiral out of control, and that's actually good for the inflation people and for commodities, because if the Fed did get aggressive, it would cause a recession. I think what people are adjusting to in the market is when you have overvalued stocks that were created for the most part by the stay-at-home trade before COVID. So if you go look at all of these charts and you go look at how they acted, the innovation growth names accelerated dramatically from basically 2019 on. Just to use a company as an example, Tesla's market cap went up dramatically. And if you look at where it was in 2019 and where it finished in 2021, it was a huge growth point of almost $1 trillion in market cap. So I think the market is still adapting to the fact that, hey, we got this wrong. Inflation's not transitory. There's a new 5 to 10 year cycle. We need to reposition. And unfortunately, with a market cap of about $1.1 trillion for Tesla at the end of last year, the entire energy sector in the United States of America's market cap was $1.1 trillion. There was a complete mispositioning. And I think we're going through what's going to be a long-term repositioning. So I don't think the tech growth thing is done yet. I think it's going to continue. And it's because rates will continue to move higher, inflation will be higher, and people are underweight, whether it's through passive investments, benchmarks at the pension level. They just don't have enough commodities in there. So I'd be rotating more and more into commodities over the course of the year.
So how do you kind of, from a valuation perspective, kind of contextualize kind of the high growth tech area, knowing that obviously, you know, really high multiples were kind of being paid for these really growthy names with, you know, higher terminal values and less obviously, you know, cash flows being generated at the business level in the short term versus what is in most cases a 60 to 80% retracement versus their recent highs. How do you kind of square away how much more they might kind of decline versus how much you think they're kind of poised now for, if nothing else, at least, you know, a stop of the bleeding?
Well, to answer this, I'm going to take everyone listening on a 30-year journey of cycles. And I think it's important, and people, you know, may not know what to do with it before it starts, but I think afterwards they'll get a sense because it'll directly answer the question with a period of time. As I mentioned, I started in the 1990s, and in 1994, two things occurred. One, I was trading Mexico at the time, and we got a devaluation in Mexico, and the rest of the 90s was spent with foreigners moving into the dollar. And at the same time, oil went from 40 in 1991 down to 10 in 1998 during LTCM. One other thing happened in 1994, which is Marc Andreessen co-founded Netscape and Web 1.0 was born. The reason I bring that up is the relationship between the dollar technology and commodities or energy has been there forever. And I do mean forever. And so you either have an overinvestment in energy or you have an overinvestment in technology. Those are the cycles that have gone. So that cycle in the 1990s went from 1990 until 1999 into 2000. Then in 2000, we get the end of the internet bubble. Oil is at $10. It goes to $145 over the course of the next 8 years into 2008. Tech during that period was uninvestable. So you got a scenario where tech multiples continued to come in. Inflation was on the higher side because commodities were going higher. And you got an overinvestment beginning in energy and an underinvestment in technology. Then 2008, two things straddle that year. Forget the great financial crisis, believe it or not. One is that the iPhone comes out in 2007. So the smartphone is born. The App Store comes out 2 years later. And at the same time, fracking becomes the major story in the world in 2010. And what happens is you've had an overinvestment in energy because energy prices were at $145. The energy sector is uninvestable. The housing market is uninvestable because we had overinvestment in housing. Without the housing market, we don't have the auto market. We don't have the furniture market. And for the next decade, the only thing left to invest in is technology. Energy goes from 145, it goes to negative during COVID, but let's just say down to 25 in 2016, and you get the reverse where technology is dominated. And now what you're starting is the next cycle. And for all investors there, they are overinvested in technology. The global market, at this point, 60% of MSCI World is US stocks. The US stock market is overowned throughout the globe, and most of that is technology. The top seven companies in MSCI World are US tech companies, if you include Tesla as a tech company. That weighting in the MSCI world is 14% for those seven companies. Japan the UK and China are the three biggest country weights underneath it. Their total sum is only 13%. Technology stocks are overowned. This will be a long drawn out liquidation phase and rotation into global stocks and into commodity-based stocks, because we're now on the next cycle of energy where we're going to have underinvestment in tech because we've had overinvestment. You're going to have a beginning of overinvestment in energy, which we're already seeing, and all Russia-Ukraine does is exacerbate it. And then one other thing for people to realize, Web 2.0 brought us the mega cap stocks that we have today. Web 3.0 is based on the crypto and the blockchain. It will disrupt all technology companies because it's a global movement. It's a borderless internet. And what that means is that innovation wave has to be done. So people should be long Bitcoin, not only as a hedge against their portfolio in terms of innovation underperforming, it's the way for them to help on a rotation. So they should be selling some of their tech names and making sure they have 5 to 10% in crypto. And I'll just give you one other factoid, which we can talk about later. When Web 2.0 was born, Amazon in 2009 had a market cap at the end of that year of $60 billion. In 2017, mid-year, it hit a market cap of $500 billion. So $60 billion to $500 billion over the course of 8 years. Ethereum last year started or hit in November of 20 was $60 billion. It hit $500 billion in November of last year. So it took 1 year what it took Amazon 8+ years. People need to have money in Bitcoin. They need to have money in Ethereum. And the crypto market is going to be the major competitor for that.
So I'm just kind of curious, just to kind of play off the crypto conversation a little bit. How do you kind of view the concept of valuation in terms of the crypto market relative to, again, whether or not it's a risk asset and should be more in a risk off mode right now and kind of, you know, paralleling what high growth tech is? How do you kind of square away crypto and, you know, really how differentiated should people think of it as? Relative to either tech or even in some cases gold, which obviously is rallying quite a bit nowadays.
Yeah, so this is a bigger topic, Peter. I'm happy to come on another time and talk about this because I think it's so important. But I'll just give you kind of my view. When people hear crypto, they have to separate this concept of gold slash currencies, and they have to think about crypto. When I say Bitcoin, I view it as SPYs. When I say Ethereum, I view it as Qs. There's a lot of reasons for that, but think of SPYs as the SPYDER, the S&P 500, as kind of being the most stable asset in the world. So when people are looking for stability, they'd rather own the S&P than the Shanghai Composite, than emerging markets, than Euro stocks, than the Nikkei. The S&P is the gold market of kind of stability. Bitcoin is the stability of the crypto market. Ethereum is the growth stage. In the new world, right now, the market cap of crypto is about $2.2 trillion. The market cap of the fiat world, which is all assets globally, is about $500 trillion. That ecosystem of $2.2 trillion is gathering both people and money from the fiat system every day because that's where the innovation is. It should not be about gold and people hiding in there. There is some element of that, and I think when it was originally started, the Bitcoin paper came out not coincidentally, 1 month after Lehman Brothers in October of 2008. And it was founded because people were frustrated with the financial system. But within there, the blockchain was the most important part. And we're now seeing innovation within the blockchain, which will directly compete with all companies. And so when you're thinking about that market and what's going to happen, the incumbent side, the way that people try to find the incumbents, there are no incumbents truly in the crypto world if it does what it's supposed to do. Instead of 5 winners, there's supposed to be 10,000 smaller winners. And so to give you an example, in the blockchain world, an Uber, which is a global company, becomes a regional city by city by city, having their own Ubers all on the blockchain, where the company is owned by the drivers and the users and not by a middleman. And that is going to take some time, but the disruption comes by hurting the growth rates of these companies. And so when you hurt the growth rates and things are being priced according to sales, you're hurting the valuation and they come down. So the blockchain is already disrupting these. And so the way that I use a measure, and I did this on my webinar last week, I look at Bitcoin relative to, say, an innovation index. The best one I can find is ARK. And if you look at Bitcoin relative to ARK, that's the way you should be measuring the success that Bitcoin is having. And if there was a rotation from those types of investment vehicles into Bitcoin, people would be investing in the innovation of the future versus the competitors that I think are going to suffer relative to that crypto market.
And then, so, you know, I think you, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show, but also I think, you know, based on our conversation, it's still the current view, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just talking again about the S&P, you know, for 2022, you still kind of view it as being flat to slightly up, or has kind of recent events kind of caused you to anchor a little bit lower on your price targets?
No, nothing has surprised me. In fact, I just sent this to someone. And again, all my stuff is in the webinars. I expected multiple and still do 10% corrections this year as the market adapts to one of inflation. One thing I'm very surprised about, I mean, we are higher right now in price, at least when we started this, than we were at the lows on January 24th. So if you go back to January 24th and think about how much bad news has been built into the market, we've added three or four more Fed tightening expectations. We've got a war going on where the search engine trends for World War III are at unprecedented levels, and yet somehow the market hasn't gone down. We've seen a massive deleveraging with inside the concentrated hedge fund space, which, as you mentioned, has led to, you know, 30 to 50% declines in a lot of popular innovation and growth names. And yet the S&P 500 is just sitting here. So I expected there to be a lot of corrections this year. I still expect oil to go higher. At this point, I not only think it'll still finish, I won't say flat, I will say less than 10%, but it'll finish up. If I had to err at this point, given what I think has now happened with Russia, Ukraine, I would actually think the market maybe even be higher than what I thought at the beginning of the year. And the reason that I say that is because there's been a concerted effort around the globe to create stimulus. China is aggressively stopping their market from, you know, their housing market, and now their even stock market as of last night, from falling. So I think this might be a bigger event where the global central banks and the global leaders, because of the Russia-Ukraine situation, are being forced to deal with the panic in a way that I didn't think they were going to do. And I think that ends up with a much easier monetary policy than I actually anticipated for this year.
And it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned China stepping in a little bit, while the Fed, you know, probably is in a position, unlike recent crises, where they are less likely to really step in and more likely, I think you'd probably agree, to kind of maintain their current communicated path. And I'm not sure the market's pricing in. Certainly today is a Fed or an FOMC decision day. I think, you know, the probability of a hike is at or near 100%. I think it's still likely to only be 25 basis points, but perhaps they surprise a little bit to the upside. But the Fed really not being able to kind of step in, or I guess maybe a better way to ask it is, do you envision the Fed starting to pull back any of their kind of current communicated policy in order to create more stimulus in the market? Or do you think that they kind of maintain what they're doing and leave it to the PBOCs of the world?
Well, I think what you have to remember is when people talk about what the Fed's going to do, and I think this is an element that it gets driven by sensationalism of strategists, economists, and subsequently the media. Markets do not move based on decisions. They move based on expectations of decisions. And the expectations are that the Fed currently is going to go every single meeting this year. I think there is very little risk of that. Let's put it this way. If that was the base case, which is where the market is, I will take the under on that in a big way. I just do not see seven hikes coming in with an election coming up if I believe that inflation is peaking. So the mistake that I think people are making is there's a couple of things that are important for monetary policy. The expectations part, I'm telling you, they've got seven hikes built in. So that's one every meeting. I don't see that happening. But let's assume it did happen. The other thing that could happen, which is very stimulative at this point, is people have to start realizing if inflation comes down, that is a stimulus now. The number one thing that is tightening the markets is the fear of inflation. It's having some sort of demand destruction. And I believe with the reopening going on, that should be the focus. I believe the inflation stuff has been impacted significantly by the bottlenecks. Corporations will be decided this year on productivity. And unit labor costs suggest that productivity numbers are going to remain high. We don't talk about the benefits that have come from COVID from a productivity basis. But one of them is that hedge fund, that companies have been able to restructure their cost structure. There's not as much travel going on. People are working from home. There's been wage issues, but the productivity numbers have been showing up. We had record profits last year. And at this point, a lot of people are talking about estimate revisions coming down. But the reality is profits are still going higher, which means every day that the market goes lower, the multiples are going lower. It's getting cheaper and cheaper. And that's the pull and push. The equity market right now, assuming even a 22 PE for the S&P, if you use this year's earnings, it's lower. Let's assume 20 to make it easy. The earnings yield of 1/20 is 5%. 10-year rates are still only 2% and change. You get a buyback yield, you get a dividend yield. So as long as earnings are growing this year, every day that the market goes by, it's getting cheaper. So when it falls, it goes. So I still think that as people kind of go through this, the number one stimulus for this year will either be that the Fed doesn't do 7, which is what's expected, or number two, inflation comes down more than what people expect at this point. And I hear people talking 10% double-digit inflation. I don't see that happening. I think core inflation is going to fall significantly lower than what people think. Headline might stay higher, but I'll finish on this. The 20-day rate of change on crude oil as we speak today is the lowest since December, which means that all of this hype over energy and crude the last 20 days, which includes Russia invading Ukraine, it's at the lowest level since December. So people are getting a little bit too hyped up, in my opinion, on inflation at a time when we're about to reopen and things should start getting a little bit better.
So you've talked quite a bit around, you know, potentially considerations around allocating to commodities or commodity sensitive companies, perhaps, certainly maybe at the expense of underweighting current portfolios, or at least relative to what they were, you know, to kind of high growth tech. And I'm kind of curious, you know, do you view that kind of, you know, potential allocation considerations to be more of a value play? Do you think that value is, you know, too archaic of a term and really it's about finding the right commodity oriented businesses? And then also within that, do you focus on companies with high operating leverage, which really might benefit from, you know, the underlying commodity really accelerating and then all of a sudden profits hopefully following? Can you maybe walk everyone through a little bit of your thoughts around those?
Yeah, we're coming out of a very unique period of time. So when people say value growth, the one thing they have to put into it is what's created this value situation. The reality is energy companies are insanely cheap. I mean, there's no other way to say it. MLPs and even the big cap energy names, you're getting paid huge dividends on these things. So MLPs and energy were beloved in 2010 when oil was up at $100 and now they're hated. So the value has been created primarily because all of the things related to, say, the old economy are very cheap relative to the things that are very expensive. So the very expensive stuff are all the, let's say, the smaller cap and the innovation, you know, techie names. That's just the reality of where we are. So if commodities continue to do better, value is going to outperform growth if for no other reason that the value names just happen to be the names that are most sensitive to commodities and kind of higher nominal GDP. I will say this, and this is the point I've made to pension allocators and to our PMs, to use a phrase from Tommy Boy or a joke, fat guy in a little coat. When you've got the tech sector, including Tesla, Google, the names that are not part of the technology sector, when you're dealing with almost 40% of the S&P being technology companies, if you add in the biotech companies, you've got an enormous amount of stocks and market cap that are in this technology side. And the energy sector market cap is less than 3%. I mean, fat guy in a little coat, if you try to get out of your tech names and rotate into energy, you'll see what you've seen this year, which is massive outperformance in the energy names because the volume it takes to sell these tech names, to rotate into the energy names, in the same way that you see the tech names come down, if you try to put $1 billion into energy, there's just not enough liquidity. And so it has to go up a lot more. The same thing to me will happen in global stocks, emerging markets. I gave you the things that I thought would happen this year. There's one thing in particular that has not happened this year that I'm watching, which is the dollar. I did a podcast on de-dollarization. It's a major theme, not only for me, but I think for the other macro people, or at least one of the other macro people in the firm, in terms of this concept. And the Ukraine-Russia story adds to the de-dollarization. If de-dollarization is a story, then you should see the dollar weaken. So far this year, the dollar has been resilient. And I think that's because of the normal flight to safe haven status. But over the course of, let's say, the last week and a half, we've seen a change in the other safe haven that I like to watch, which is money moving from euros into Swiss francs. Initially, that was going Swiss franc was when Russia invaded Ukraine, was outperforming the euro. We've seen a shift in that. So I'm watching to see if the dollar starts weakening, then that becomes another major theme, which fits in with the same picture, which is you need to invest in the inflationary side. And that means emerging markets, foreign stocks, and I think they'll outperform the US as well.
No, that's great and really helpful. I do have one question on kind of the global slash international or global ex-US kind of international versus US kind of trade. You know, we've seen these kind of be super cycles. And I think, you know, it was the 2000 to 2007 period or so where international really outperformed the US. I'm not sure if that's on a hedge basis too, but let's just remove considerations for FX for now. And I think coming out of the global financial crisis, the US has outperformed in magnitudes never seen before. relative to international companies. What kind of leads you to believe that that cycle might kind of be changing now with international outperformance?
Well, this goes back to the 30-year history lesson that I gave in the relationship, the relationship between the dollar, innovation, and energy. So the U.S. is obviously heavily skewed towards innovation. If all of a sudden people need to invest in commodities or inflation, then the foreign markets are going to do much better than the U.S. just by the nature of what you're investing in. And so you mentioned 2000 to 2007. That's exactly what I said about when the last time energy did well. So I agree completely with what you're saying, but people have to realize the United States of America dominated Web 1.0. 47 square miles in Northern California, Silicon Valley created all the innovation that the world needed basically from 1994 until 2000. We had a bubble in the internet. We saw a lot of companies that went out. And then as that bubble ended, money started flowing into other parts of the world because the US was overinvested in innovation and the market cap was overinvested in innovation. I think we're in the exact same point. It's very obvious. The only difference is what saved the world after the great financial crisis was Web 2.0, which we again dominated. Google controls 93% of search in Europe. All of these rules are changing. Everyone realizes now that if you have the US as a dominant part of your life, what Russia is going through right now is an isolation. And that isolation is using the dollar as a weapon, but it's also the fact whenever they talk about, we're shutting off Facebook, we're shutting off Google, they're shutting off US tech companies. China did the same thing in my travels there, and they prepared for this. So that's why China had the growth in Alibaba, Tencent, and all these. They already got rid of Twitter, of Facebook, of Instagram, all these things. And so when Facebook comes out and the stock falls off dramatically and you go try to figure out why, aside from their Meta movement and spending too much money, it's competition from TikTok, which is a Chinese company. The borderless internet is the major story for everyone. We controlled Web 1.0. We controlled Web 2.0 because of the App Store and the iPhone. Web 3.0 is a global phenomenon with many, many winners, but they are regional. So I've called this the beginning of fragmentation. We've been in a world of centralization. The end result is technology has delayed a process where the rest of the world would get off of the US needs. And just think about China-US divorce, which occurred from 2016 to 2020, is still in place. The world is becoming fragmented. Each place needs to depend on their own region. And whether you call it re-regionalization, fragmentation, de-dollarization, it's happening. And if people want to protect against this, again, they need to invest in the internet, which is Web 3.0. That's crypto. It is not crypto company. It is crypto. That's the ecosystem. And the second thing they need to do is overweight into non-US stuff and commodity-based things. That's what I see happening for the next at least 3 years, but more likely it's a cycle, like you mentioned, that'll last 5 to 10 years.
That's fantastic. You know, we spoke about a lot, and I'm not sure if there's anything that you felt that we didn't get a chance to cover that you wish that we did.
The only thing, and we've kind of touched on a bunch of different things, but the only thing I think is important for people, in doing these allocator conversations with pension funds, obviously I'm dealing differently than I do with RIAs and FAs, but the reality is everyone's in the same predicament. If you wake up every day going, what am I doing in the bond portion of my portfolio? If it truly is uninvestable, you have to make decisions on it. And I think the complexity of that being on at the same time as this cycle shift, assuming I'm right, and I believe energy is going to continue to move higher, whether it's 200, 300, 400, 500, I don't care. I think it's going to be a steady increase. Eventually, it will accelerate at some point. If that is the case and you are not prepared for it, you have to decide what to do with all these things. But the most important thing in your portfolio is to make a decision are related to bonds because it's priced for disinflation. And then any passive investments you've made in the S&P and any of these things, by definition, they are heavily skewed with what's worked the last 10 years because the market caps have shifted so dramatically. And those market caps are reflective of a disinflationary world where the US controls concentration. These conversations are very important to have. I think the reason that I've started to do podcasts and the reason I do the webinars is to try and help investors think about this. But it's not just the end investors. It is the allocators. It is the model portfolios. It is everyone who might be listening to this. So I'm happy to spend time on it. But that's the major thing, is at a minimum, you need to be thinking about these now, because I think this is only the very beginning, which started in November of last year. And the reason that it's a secular thing is because until November of last year, very few people expected inflation to be here. They thought it was transitory. I've been pounding the table since May of 2020, coming out of COVID, that the amount of money that was printed and the ability of central banks around the world to kind of control deflation through a pandemic, which to me was unprecedented, their fear should be that they don't know how to get inflation back into the bottle. And the reason that's an issue is because of the debt that's outstanding. And so very seldom when you hear people saying inflation's happening, I'm scared, I need to raise rates. The reality is there's going to be negative real rates for a long time. And that puts pressure on your portfolios to find things that will do well in inflation, higher nominal GDP. And I think that's the conversation that, even though we've talked about, we've kind of fragmentedly brought it up, I think it's important to think about it and to have this conversation.
That's great. I've got one other follow-up, and we got just a couple more minutes as well. But you mentioned a lot of talk around asset allocators. And, you know, typically we think about, you know, some of these large pension funds, global sovereign wealth funds, really, you know, people with large dollar amounts that allocate across many different asset classes in many different countries. You know, I know that there's been kind of some rumblings that should they kind of start to reallocate or reposition their portfolio at quarter end, it could kind of be something that is a catalyst to help propel equities higher. Any thoughts on that thesis overall?
Well, the thought I will have on it is, you know, based on surveys that I think have been publicized, Bank of America does one called the Fund Manager Survey. It recently came out with the highest cash levels since COVID. And in every other time that you go back, these are very high levels and usually associated close to a bottom. When cash levels are that high, it's always a good thing for the market. But when you add in the fact that inflation is high, and bonds are not an effective place to be. If people wanted to reallocate out of bonds at some point, getting a huge fall in the equity market at this point is fine, because even though bonds are down a lot as well, I don't see how you're going to make as much money in bonds from here to the end of the year as you are stocks if you believe inflation is going to be higher. So to your point, I think with cash levels at these levels, with negative real rates at these levels, it's going to force them to invest in another asset. Despite the fact that I love commodities, what hurts a lot of pension fund allocators is the fact that they are still restricted in many ways from ESG, from investing in fossil fuels. And so that makes it very, very challenging for them to move into commodities. So that means that I think they have no option but to buy more stocks, and probably to allocate stock to indices that have more sensitivity to inflation, which will be more global. So I think overall, to your point, allocators are kind of are restricted by the inflationary environment, but also by the ESG mandates, which don't allow them to invest in commodities the way they otherwise would right now. That also means that commodities should have more of a gradual increase and not a spiral, which is very positive for the markets, because if that occurs, then inflation goes down. So I do think for quarter end, you are going to see buyers in stocks relative to bonds.
Okay, that's fantastic. Jordy, thank you so much for joining us today. I thought this was incredibly insightful and really helps people understand, you know, some of the market dynamics and also the undercurrents of what's kind of happening beyond, you know, what you see really in the S&P overall for more, broader market performance. Also, thank you to all of our listeners. Remember to visit yieldtreat.com to learn more about our offerings and come to realize your next level with us. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. Thanks again and see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.